So many people read mystery novels despite all the changes in the publishing business. Whether they're in paperback or on an e-reader screen, people still thrill to figuring out whodunit. Somebody has to have the answer to that question and provide the story details that make us want to know whodunit. And today's guest is that somebody. April Henry is a successful mystery writer living in Portland. She's a Rogue Valley native and a regular visitor, including a trip this week that includes speaking to high school students in Medford and Ashland. So, April Henry, good to have you back on the program again.
It's great to be here, and I'm so glad you told me about I-5 being closed down, because the next place I'm going to go is Medford, so I am going to have to avoid the freeway.
Had you not come down? Oh, because you didn't come down.
I came down at night, yeah.
Right, all right. So, yeah, different situation. Well, see, we try to help out our audience one listener at a time. I'm curious about the formation of the interest in what led to a career in writing mysteries. I know that your dad, Hank Henry, was a Jackson County commissioner. Before that, a longtime television news person in the Rogue Valley. Apparently had a camera in the trunk of his car just about all the time.
And yeah.
You were along with him a lot.
There was a lot of times where my dad would see some cop cars and we would pull over and he would, I'd be sitting in the car and he would go out and start filming or talking to the cops to see what was going on. So I remember seeing somebody that some legs in the bushes and in a ditch one time, or we saw some bad car accidents when we were growing up. But it wasn't like we just happened to be there when it happened. So, but even when he was sleeping, I remember we had instructions to wake him up if he heard more than two sirens, because that meant it was a news story and he should go out.
So he had you well trained, at least in that aspect of things. But it was, as you say, he wasn't like, hey, April, come here, look at the legs in the bush.
No, my dad was a very mild-mannered person, so it was more on accident. But I do sometimes wonder if when I was working on a book one time, I Googled my grandmother's name, which was what one naturally does when one is very behind on a deadline. And her name was Effie Satterwhite. And when I Googled it, this whole court case popped up from 1907 Arkansas Supreme Court decision. And I thought, that's weird. This lady has the same name as my grandmother. And then the more I looked, the more I recognized other names. And I realized it was my grandmother. And when she was 18, she was dating this guy. And the parents had fought with them about how close they were getting. And so what happened was they had gone out on a date and he kissed her and she pushed him away and they talked and he kissed her again and she didn't push him away. And when she was going in the house, she heard a sound and it was the sound of her dad running down the stairs with a gun. And he went out in the street and he called out this boy's name and he shot him. And then when my grandmother ran up to this dying boy and tried to hold his head in her lap, he told her it was all her fault. So, that means that I'm the great-granddaughter of a murderer. So it could be that there's the killing instinct is coming out in a better way in me. It's been, I guess, thinned out.
Better to imagine it and write about it.
Yeah,
than
yeah.
To perform the act itself. So did you have a backup career planned? I mean,
most writers have day jobs for a long time. I haven't had one since 2008. I've been really lucky, but for a long time, I wrote and worked full-time at Kaiser Permanente as a writer. So it was a different kind of writing, but it was really good training because it taught you that you could not wait for, if somebody expects you to write a brochure about what you need to know about your ovarian cancer, you can't say, well, the muse is not with me right now. I will write that later. You have to sit down and you have to write it. So it was good training that you're going to get results if you sit down and work on it, even if at the time it doesn't feel that good. You can always make something that's not very good better, but if you haven't written anything, you can't make it better.
But that must have been a really good place to learn research as well, because you had to be able to write authoritatively about subject matter for people who were not authorities themselves, it had to be correct medically.
Right. Well, there was a lot of interviewing going on, but that was actually a lot of stuff took place kind of before the internet. Now, with the internet, has really changed around how I write and how I do research, because there's so much available. I can get in contact with people. I can email people. I can find first-person accounts of what it's like to be shot, for example, or what it's like to almost drown. There's just a lot on the internet that's probably made me a better researcher, because I feel like now you have no excuse for getting things wrong. It used to be that if you didn't, you might not even know where to go look to find correct information. And people might be writing just based on what they saw on TV or movies, which a lot of times isn't correct.
Right. I didn't have that book or I didn't have that article. Well, now you don't have those complaints anymore.
Right.
And you're able to find information about your grandmother, too.
Yes.
By Googling. Your career actually got started fairly early, it sounds like. At least you're getting really into depth in writing with the help of a known writer.
Yes, when I was in grade school, maybe like fifth or sixth grade, I wrote Roald Dahl. My dad had told me that you could write people care of their publishers. And so I thought that Roald Dahl, who wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I felt like he was probably one of my good friends, you know. And I wrote a short story about a 6-foot-tall frog named Herman who loved peanut butter. And I sent it to him, care of his publisher, and somehow it made its way over to London. And then he sent me back a postcard, and he told me that he had read it to his daughter, Ophelia, and his secretary, Hazel, and that they both really liked it. And what he didn't say in his postcard was that later on that day, he took it with him to a lunch with his editor, Kay Webb, and she had a publication called the Puffin Post. And that was for mostly English school children, and they would actually have kids' articles and stories in there. So
Roald Dahl really helped get a foothold in the writing world.
Yeah, he really did.
Much more to talk about with April Henry, the mystery writer. She's got a forthcoming book, and we'll talk about all the books behind her as well. The Body in the Woods is the one coming up. She's in Ashland to talk to high school students in Ashland and in Medford over the next couple of days. And she'll be our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break to take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is April Henry, a Rogue Valley native and mystery writer back in the Rogue Valley for a couple of different events we'll talk about in just a moment. But you can talk to us about the process of writing mysteries and how April got so good at it and so successful at it. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Why don't we talk about the various reasons? Because it sounds like there's at least three events that you're part of while you're in the Rogue Valley.
Yeah, tomorrow I'm going to be speaking to kids at Ashland Schools and Ashland High School. We're going to be doing some writing exercises, and I'm going to be telling them about how I got to be a writer. And one of my primary messages is don't give up on your dream, because if I'd given up, I wouldn't be where I was today. And then in the evening, I'm going to be speaking at the Medford Barnes & Noble at 7 o'clock, so that's on Tuesday. Then on Wednesday, I'm going to be speaking to South Medford High and talking to kids there.
And are you a Medford High graduate?
I am a Medford High graduate back when there was only one school, not two like there are now.
Right, okay, before they split the Black Tornado and the Panthers into two separate high schools. You mentioned not giving up on your dream. So, I mean, we just talked about Roald Dahl helping get your stuff published early on, very early in life. But what was the dream you pursued? I mean, was it always mysteries from that point forward or something else?
You know, there was in between when I was like 11 and in my 30s, there was probably a long period where I really didn't think I could be a writer. It felt like writers probably were special people that everyone always said that they were the best writer in school, that you probably spoke French and you went to a boarding school and you had a horse. I think I started getting it confused with being rich. I was a good student, but I really didn't stand out in school. It wasn't like I was the person who was thought to be the one who was really going to succeed. And but when I was in my 30s, I started thinking maybe I could write, and that's when I started pursuing that dream. And I took some writing classes with people who are better writers, and they got a few rejections from agents and gave up. So if I hadn't kept going, I wouldn't be where I am now, which is as a New York Times bestselling author, making a good living as a writer. So I'm really glad that I kept forward. And a lot of that, I think, I owe to my parents, that they were very supportive of me and always felt like it would work out for me.
They encourage you to go for your dream, and they weren't all about, you know, make sure you get a degree in something else, not just an English
degree. No. Well, by that time, I already had a degree, but when I started writing, my dad actually brought out all these books from the 50s, like Characters Make Your Story, that he had kept when I guess he had wanted to be a novelist but never really found the time or didn't pursue his dream.
In a way, you're carrying on his dream, then.
I am. It makes me very happy that that happened and that my and that they were alive to see my success, especially my mom.
The concept you talked about where you were thinking that the, you know, the people who made it well as writers are the people who maybe were the best writer in school, that sort of thing. I'd be curious to know if you were able to, I mean, do you remember who the best writer in your high school was and what happened to that person, whether they ended up even close to doing anything like that?
I'd say, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about some of the people who are real standouts. Like there was Sheila Schmitz, who was like, I think, really did a lot of editorial work. And she actually is the editor for an online place called Houzz, H-O-U-Z-Z.com. It's like a place where you can go and figure out what it is you want to, how you want to change your house and look at different things. It's kind of like Pinterest, only for houses.
Fun. So what were you always thinking of mysteries? I mean, because you're obviously the story
about...
Oh,
that's right. Asked me that. Sorry, I dropped that question. Well, when I wrote a book that was about kind of a coming-of-age story, and that one didn't go anywhere, and then I wrote a book that was kind of an historical about the orphan trains, and that one didn't go anywhere, and then I wrote Circles of Confusion, which I didn't think was a mystery, and my agent said, I think this will sell well as a mystery. And I said, you can call it a cookbook. You can call it anything. If you think it will sell, I don't care. And so now I feel, you know, now that I've got, I think it's my 16th and 17th books are coming out in June, and I think it would be hard for me actually to sell something that wasn't a mystery unless I changed my name, just like Kellogg's. I see they've ventured into crackers now, mm-hmm. but if Kellogg's made toothpaste or shampoo, you probably wouldn't buy it. So I feel like my brand right now is mysteries and thrillers. And it turns out I like learning police procedure. I like learning about forensics. I like talking to DNA experts. It's all, and I like doing some of the stuff I do, like spending a day with a guy who's a forensics guy, or in Portland, I spend a day there, or taking a 5-hour class on fighting in close quarters, that kind of thing.
All kinds of fun things to learn, some of the techniques that would be used by the people who exist in your books. Would you ever think about maybe expanding from the April Henry brand, using a pseudonym and writing a different
kind of book? I have thought about that. When I have a little bit more free time lately, I've just had deadline after deadline where I literally put down a book, turn it in, and the next day I open up another document and start another book. So this summer we'll turn in one big project, and then I'm hoping to have some relaxation time to think about doing something a little different.
Tell us about the writing process. I know that we've had P.K. Hallinan, who lives in the Ashland area and is a children's book author, published many times over, has talked about people may tell you writing's fun. It's not.
Well, there's times where it's fun. Mm-hmm. Having written is always fun when you're done writing.
When you're done, yeah. Like a cross-country race.
You're always happy that you did it. Uh-huh. So there's times where it's really fun and there's times where it's work. But for me, it's things like I was just at the Houston Teen Book Con and some parents had driven 2.5 hours with their daughter there because they said I changed her life and turned her into a reader. And they made a whole weekend out of being in Houston just for her. So that's the kind of thing that makes it worthwhile. Sometimes it's not the immediate, I put in my 2,000 words, but it's the feeling of seeing how you impact people.
Did you like reading mysteries much before you were writing them?
I've always probably read about a third mysteries and thrillers, a third literary fiction. And right now it's like a third young adult, just a whole mixed bag of young adult.
We have a question for you. Here's Mara in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with April Henry, the mystery writer. Mara, go ahead.
Hi, sorry. I didn't hear you quite. Anyway, April, hi. My son is a burgeoning writer. He is really talented, and he's really smart, and he's really capable, and he also is not able to attend any of your speaking engagement, mm-hmm. which is kind of a bummer for me because I would love for him to meet you. And additionally, your story about Roald Dahl, I love that because that was my experience with Ray Bradbury growing up.
Hmm.
My mom knew him, and so I got to meet him, and he was kind of my like ad hoc mentor. So I relate to you. I think that's really cool that you had that experience because Roald Dahl is just the most amazing person ever, so writing-wise. But I was wondering if you did any kind of like one-on-one meetings or if you were interested in maybe getting together and meeting my son because I think he would really benefit from that. And, you know, we live in such a small town that for him it's hard finding good opportunities to meet with people such as yourself.
Well,
thanks for the call, Mara. Appreciate it.
Right now, my schedule for the next 3 days is really booked because my mom just died, and there's a bunch of her estate that needs to be taken care of while I'm down here, and I'm meeting some of her friends. So I actually literally don't have a free time when I'm here. However, there's a couple of things I would suggest. One is there's a book called Writing Magic by Gail Carson Levine that I really like. Another thing is your son could contact me through my website. There is a form right on the main page of AprilHenryMysteries.com that he could fill out. And I could tell him the next time I was going to be in town, because my brother still lives in Medford, and we could maybe get together then. And also, if he had any questions about writing, he could send them to me. So those are some other opportunities, but unfortunately my time right now is just too booked for that.
Yeah, it sounds like you have quite a full schedule, but I mean, these meetings that you have at Ashland High School and South Medford High School, are they unusual? Do you get to talk to the youth groups fairly often?
I talk to students all the time in school, so that's another option, I guess, if you wanted to see if Talon wanted to bring me in to speak to the schools. Like tomorrow when I speak at Ashland, that's being sponsored by the Ashland Schools Foundation. But I just got back from – I was just in St. Louis. I did 3 days of school visits there. I was just in the Detroit area doing school visits there. I'm going to be in Illinois doing school visits. And so I probably do two or three a month where I do school visits. And I like to do in-state ones and give a good discount for those.
April Henry is our guest, Rogue Valley native, now Portland resident, and published mystery writer several times over, more than a dozen books to her name, either singly or jointly with another author. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the work process and how April got to where she is today. Phone numbers here on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. You have pointed out in other interviews that your first book was really not your first book.
It was actually my fourth book even before those books where I was talking that didn't get published, there was another one I wrote that didn't get an agent. So when I first got my agent, I had sent out query letters and portions of manuscripts to agents, and I had probably gotten back 50 rejection letters. And some of them, you know, they would just photocopy them and they'd say, "Dear author," or if they didn't want to spend the money on having a whole piece of paper, they would photocopy it twice and cut it in half. Or one person just crossed out my letter and wrote the word "no" in big with a Sharpie.
Oh, no.
And then my agent that I have now, she called me and she said she wanted to represent me. And she said it was one of the best books she'd ever read. And she said it was so lovely. She said, you know, she was sure that no other agents had looked at it because I was sitting there thinking, well, you're like number 51. And so I didn't know what to say to her. So I said, well, a few other agents have looked at it. And her voice changed and she said, how many? And I said, four, which was like a total lie. It was undercounting by about 47. So, and she still doesn't know. I mean, I talk about it, but luckily she's never heard any of the interviews or seen anything where I've said that she was number 51. So I think that just speaks again to books are really a matter of taste, and you can get a whole bookstore full of people, but they won't all agree that one book is really great. There will always be a few people that didn't like it at all. And so I think you have to be stubborn when you're out there trying to find an agent or trying to find an editor or trying to find an audience, because not everyone is going to be the right fit for your book.
So those first four books, are they still waiting for an audience?
I think that, you know, people say, well, you could go back and rewrite them and stuff. But I think I've kind of moved on. So, I mean, I think I made some amateur mistakes. There's bits about those books I still like a lot. And maybe sometime when I do have that free time, I'll go back and look. Mm-hmm. But I haven't so far.
It's a fairly common story. I'm sure you've talked to other writers about it because we've gotten it here a few times.
Right.
People say, yeah, there's one novel sitting in a drawer somewhere, and it's never going to see the light of day.
Yes.
I don't want it out.
Yeah, I'm always surprised. There was a lady I met one time who it was her first book that got published, and I couldn't believe it. I'd never met anyone like that.
When you first got published then, I mean, talk about the process of discovering that it was selling. I mean, how that information reached you, and when did it become clear, like, hey, this is really selling?
Well, It used to be there wasn't as much information available. So you know, people would say, ask you within the first week or something, they'd want to know how it was doing. And a lot of times you really didn't know. You're getting statements. I'm going to get a statement on the 1st, I think, that will be covering a time period through, I think, the end of the year. So you see, even that's not very current. But now there's ways that you can there's ways that you can see BookScan, which scans quite a few of the bookstores, like they say 70%. I'm not certain it's quite that high. But so you can see those numbers weekly, and you can start getting a feeling. It takes a long time, though, sometimes for things to catch on. One of my young adults, Girls Stolen, was actually rejected by the editor I had at the time. It's about a blind girl who's kidnapped after someone steals her car when her mom leaves the keys in the car, which is based on something that really happened in Portland. And that book, he wanted it rewritten so there wasn't a point of view of the blind girl. And I felt like, well, then how will people understand what it's like to really be blind if you're not in her point of view? So we found another editor, and that editor took it on. And just slowly over time, now it's on 9 state lists. It's won 3 best of the state awards. It's been named one of the best books in Ireland for kids. There's somebody who's trying to make it into a movie. So I think success sometimes can come really slowly, and it takes you a while to figure out that, yes, it's really working out well.
You mentioned that Girl Stolen is based on a story from Portland. Mm-hmm. Does living in Portland help mystery writing a bit? Because, I mean, believe me, I read the Oregonian daily, and it seems like there are some pretty bizarre things that happen there that it would be fodder for a mystery writer.
Well, what's very strange to me is that there's been 3 different police events that I've been kind of witness to or involved in areas that I know. Recently, there was a guy in Portland who was stalking girls, and they said he had like a rolling dungeon in his van. And he was approaching girls at Wilson High, which is next near where I live. And then he ended up being shot dead by the police, but he was shot right outside my kung fu school. And I actually could have parked where he died the other day, and I parked on the other side of the street. It just felt like it would have too bad of an energy. And then I walked out of a doctor's appointment the other day, and the street's blocked off, and there's 18 police cars, and I see this cop with a rifle, or it was a shotgun, sorry, getting my long guns confused, and but I could tell by his body language that whatever was happening was not as bad as it was earlier. And so they had just shot this guy with a beanbag round. And it sounded like he was mentally ill, so good for the police for making the right call. Because he told them he had a gun, and he had some kind of gun-like object tucked in his waistband. So that would have been a very easy one to do differently. And then when I was in St. Louis getting the Truman Award, my husband texted me and said that the whole neighborhood was shut down, and there'd been a confrontation between a cop and people who had broken into a store and stolen like police badges and body armor, and the guy had shot the cop and shot the police dog. And so it's very weird, because Southwest Portland I think of as being a very safe neighborhood, but it's just, I guess, this last few months it's not been so safe.
Right, a span of just a couple of months with all sorts of strange things happening. Are there some limits to what you're willing to put into a mystery? Are there some crimes that are so heinous or descriptions that would be so hard to do that you're just going to stop short of those?
I don't try to ever spend too much point of view of time, like I don't want to spend too much time being in the mind of a serial killer. There's stuff I would never probably do, when Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis were murdered by that guy, I don't think I would ever do anything like that, because in a way that was such a sad and creepy story, and there wasn't any, I would like there to be some redemption or some joy at the end, and so I'd have to do something that either ends well or take it and make it so that the story ended better than it did in real life. I mean, usually almost all my books have some inspiration in real life, but it'd be like it's kind of like the Law and Order approach, where you recognize the first few sentences, and then after that it takes the story in a different direction.
Yeah, the whole Law and Order promo thing about rip from the headlines, but the fact is you want to deviate from the headlines because they don't always have a particularly
good conclusion. Well, that's why people like to read mysteries and thrillers. In real life, a lot of stories are like somebody got drunk and shot someone else, and that's not really it's just a depressing story. Who wants to read that story?
Right. You freshen things up a little bit with the mystery writing. Was the Claire Montrose series, your first series, always planned that way? No, I just
wrote a book, and that was the one my agent said she felt could sell as a mystery. And then luckily she gave me a heads up. She said, you know, if they buy it, they'll probably buy two, and they'll want an idea for a second one. And so it gave me a few minutes to think about that.
And so you got four books with different shapes: Circles of Confusion, Square in the Face, Heart-Shaped Box, and Buried Diamonds.
That's right. I said if we went to tetrahedons, it would just be over.
Never got to that point. Much more to talk about with April Henry, the mystery writer. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. More with April and with you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. It's today's final segment. We're talking to April Henry, the mystery writer, now living in Portland, but originally from the Rogue Valley, the daughter of Hank Henry, longtime county commissioner and television news person before that, and quite successful mystery writer in her own right. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the process of mystery writing and what it's gotten April Henry in the world. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Why don't we run through the events you're in the Rogue Valley for again so we can make sure that people understand when and where?
Okay, I'll be speaking to Ashland High Schools tomorrow. Thanks to the Ashland Schools Foundation, I'll be at Barnes & Noble tomorrow night, so that's Tuesday, in Medford at 7, and I'll be at Medford High School, South Medford, on Wednesday.
All right. We have a couple of email questions for you here. Deb and Talent wants to know. She says, when I'm grazing on the Library to Go site, I've noticed books are categorized as mystery or crime. What's the difference? Thanks. Cool. Love your books, Deb and Talent.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how they're dividing those up unless, maybe they're using mystery for something like a more of a cozy or something that's not going to be too violent. And then they're labeling the ones that are more, have more blood in them as crime, but I'm not certain how they're doing those divisions.
Right. Well, but it sounds like it's fairly typical what you do with mysteries. And I mean, there's some resolution at the end that at least somebody comes out feeling good or
right.
Well, better.
I think you wouldn't be selling too many books if they always had a downer ending.
That could be the case. From Scott in Ashland, this email. Hi, April. A couple of questions. One, are you finished with Claire Montrose, the protagonist of your earlier books? And two, recently it seems you've had a theme of girls, young women who are kidnapped or otherwise put in vulnerable and powerless situations. Can you comment on the reasons for that focus and whether it will continue or whether you have moved on? Again, Scott in Ashland.
Well, the first question is whether the Claire Montrose books will continue. Actually, those were dropped by the publisher for you have to make a certain level of sales. And they wanted me to be selling 50% more each time, which after a while mathematically gets pretty difficult.
Boy, no kidding.
So also, I think it's just hard to sell mysteries that have a humor element in them. And those books did have quite a bit of humor in them. And for some reason, that those two things just don't go together that well. Stephanie Plum, maybe those books did well, but it's hard to think of very many others. As for girls being kidnapped, yeah, I mean, there's, I guess I always think of how would I react in a given situation. And since a lot of my books are based on things that I've seen in the news, it's just, I guess there was just a spate of time where I was seeing stories in the news about girls who were kidnapped for one reason or another. But my next book, The Body in the Woods, there's no kidnapping in it. So, and the one after that, no kidnapping. So, yeah, I guess I at least for now, I've moved on. I bet I will come back because there's a million different ways to tell that story, though.
The Body in the Woods is an accidental discovery of a body in the woods.
Yeah, they kind of go, I think the publisher went with a more obvious title. I had something different with it.
I'm curious what your title would have been.
I'm trying to think of what it was. Because now I try not to hold on to them very much because I know they won't keep them.
Right.
Oh, I think it was going to be, I was going to call it Point Last Seen, and they are calling it a Point Last Seen series. But it's based on We were sitting next to some friends a couple of years ago, almost exactly a couple of years ago, and they told us that their daughter was a volunteer for Multnomah County Search and Rescue, and I thought I knew what that did, that they went and found people who were lost in the woods. But it turns out that in Multnomah County, they have two things that make them different. The first is the organization is teen-led. Adults can be advisors, but they cannot be they cannot be leaders. And the second thing is that 30 to 40% of what they do is crime scene evidence recovery. So when there is an outdoor crime scene, it's these kids who put on their painter's kneelers and put on leather gloves and on their hands and knees right next to each other will form a line and just go forward and look for the tiniest piece of evidence. They'll find a tooth or a piece of hair or gum or a bottle, beer bottle cap or a cigarette, and they will find those for the cops, and they've been credited with helping solve dozens of mysteries by doing this.
Wow. And so you must have been out with them a few times and watched this whole process go on.
Yeah, I've been to their trainings. So I was just at one where they were learning how to man track, which is when you find a footprint and you can find other footprints. There's like techniques that they use, and you know, if you're really good, you can tell just from like an overturned leaf or a couple of grains of sand on a twig. They were showing us photos and they would say, well, obviously, and I couldn't even see the print. But when I came back, I had missed a class in our kung fu class to go to that, and so when I came back, I said I had been learning man tracking, and a woman there said that she could set me up with somebody, and not to worry. And I was like, no, I've been married for a long time. I wasn't learning how to
not
find men.
Not that kind of man tracking, right?
But yeah, the group is just really. I was out there the other day listening to them. They were having the medical examiner talk to them and show them photos of what they might see in the woods of what, because they do some body recovery sometimes, and so they were showing them what a body in the woods is going to look like. You know, if it's especially after it's been there for a while, and the kids next to me were talking about some of the things they'd seen and done, and then I stood up and it was a boy and a girl, and both of them, I was taller than both of them. It was just kind of amazing that there's these teens doing these pretty intense things.
The level of detail then, I mean, must be fascinating. I mean, it must have been a revelation to you as you watched police procedure over the years, and it sounds like you've spent a fair amount of time along with them. But noticing the things they have to do, which seem a lot more complicated than anything we ever see on the TV shows that are police procedures.
Yeah, there's just a lot of stuff that's really interesting. I go to the Writers Police Academy in North Carolina every year, and they have people out who come out who are experts in all kinds of fields. But one of the most interesting ones is these people. There's a group called Searchy that sells the equipment you need to make fingerprints and the equipment you need to do all kinds of different things. And one of the things they were showing us is we were in a room with a linoleum floor, and they just got their flashlight, and it hadn't been prepped or anything. This was just the floor, how it normally was. And by shining the flashlight at a very low angle, you could see footprints on the floor, and it was just a linoleum floor. So there's like evidence that you might not even know is there, but is there.
Have you met Kathy Reichs? I mean, isn't she from North Carolina? No, wait. I'm trying to think of where she's from.
Kathy Reichs.
From the Bone series?
Yeah,
she would have been at one of those.
I've emailed her, but I haven't met her. She hasn't come to the Writers Police Academy that I know of. Last year it was Lee Childs, and who was that? There was another person there.
All right, let's take another call for you. Here's Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with mystery writer April Henry.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Good morning, April. April, here's kind of a it may be off on a sidebar to what you were talking about, but what do you think about let's say Edgar Allan Poe? Basically, when he invented the mystery mystery novel or what it were, it started out as a short story. So, what is your take? What's your opinion on people like actually writing like say a short story mystery, say for something like I don't know, I'm 60 years old practically, and so there's these things called Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, short story things. What is your take on that? And Jeffrey, I'll take her answer off the telephone.
All right, thanks, Jamie. Get that phone cord plugged in a little more firmly.
Yes, sir.
All right, thanks.
Well, a lot of people will write mystery stories as like a complement to a longer novel or as a way to kind of get their foot in the door. If you wanted to sell it as a bigger thing, you would need a bunch of them to be part of a short story collection. And even then, it might be hard to sell. I don't a mystery short story collection. But I think it's a great idea in terms of just kind of getting some name recognition, getting your stuff out there. So I don't work very well in the short form because I feel like it has to turn on a dime. There's usually a resolution that's very quick within a paragraph and kind of everything. There's an aha moment. And I don't feel like I'm good at being that short. So
there needs to be, I mean, it's more like life, I guess, the process of writing a novel. It's going to be a series of events that happen over an extended period of time.
Right. Or mine might take place in as short a time as a week just to keep the tension up. But I guess I have maybe 50 to 80,000 words to play with, whereas a short story maybe is 2 or 3,000.
I read a blog about making good mysteries. It was called Just Add Tension. So are you consciously thinking about how to raise the stakes, raise the tension as you go through?
Oh,
is it something
yeah.
you go back and add later on?
Oh, no. I think you better start out with it. So a lot of things I'll do are kind of mechanical, but they work really well. It's like having short chapters. If I'm reading a book and I'm thinking I need to go to sleep pretty soon, I'll page ahead. And if there's 37 pages before I can stop reading, I'll just stop reading then. But if there's 2 pages or 3 pages, and then you get to the end of those 3 pages and there's a huge surprise and you have to keep reading. So besides having short chapters, I try to have a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter. And then I'm just thinking about what could I do to raise the stakes, to raise the tension, to make it so it's more important to the reader. You know, it's not just that, you know, one kid's going to die, it's the whole kindergarten. Or it's not just that you have to catch the serial killer, but your girlfriend is going to be the next person to die. So just doing something so that you can raise the stakes.
With all the time you've spent hanging around police and going to the Writers Police Academy, first of all, have you ever watched the TV show Castle about the writer who hangs out with the police and ends up getting a place with them?
I've watched it like once or twice. I mean, it's kind of far-fetched. So
I thought it would be a bit of an eye roller for you.
However, in a weird twist, the guy who plays Detective Ryan on the show mm-hmm. is, we have sort of the same aunt.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt got divorced from my uncle and remarried his great uncle. So she got him into show business. So we've emailed each other back and forth. His name is Seamus Deaver.
Seamus Deaver, that's right. Okay, yeah. I knew it was Seamus something. I almost said Seamus Hanian. I know I couldn't get away with that one. A different person altogether. What are the differences then in writing for young adult audiences and versus writing for not young adults?
Maybe other writers do this differently. I don't write any differently, other than there's probably one or two fewer subplots so that I can keep the books. I try and keep my young adults down to 50,000 words. And, of course, all the characters are teens. I get a lot of crossover readers from older people reading my young adult books or even young adults reading my older, even though I wonder why they'd want to read about a 39-year-old or whatever. But I don't really write them any differently. But for some, in young adult terms, there's words they have that they don't use in adult books. Well, no, that sounds different. What I mean is there's a term called reluctant readers. And so there's teens that don't like to read, but in school, you have to read some. As adults, we just give up on people who don't like to read. And so I am kind of the go-to person for young adults who don't like to read. Librarians will get my books into those kids' hands, and I'll get emails from them saying that they've now become readers because of the books that I write. So it's they're high interest books, and their reading level is not super complicated. I don't start out to make it that way, but that's just how it turns out.
I was just thinking about the fact that your career spans a really interesting stretch in publishing history with The Circles of Confusion, published in 1999 before the first e-reader, and here we are 15 years later, and it's a different kind of world out there.
I was telling Laurie Halsa Anderson a couple nights ago. She's a pretty well-known young adult author, that I wish that I was 10 years older or 10 years younger, because I feel like I came up in the middle of everything, and it's hard to straddle how much things have changed. It used to be people who self-published were crazy, deluded people who had piles of books in their basement that they never sold anyone, and now there's people who can make a really good living off of self-publishing. However, those people are probably outliers, just like people who are just like J.K. Rowling is not how every writer's life is.
Yeah, no doubt. And nobody could be quite that lucky. Or not everybody can be that lucky. Given your awareness of crime and your writing of mysteries, I mean, are there times when you are aware of stories in the news that are mysteries themselves, and you begin to make some
I totally have a book that's going to, I'm working on right now. There, 2 years ago, there was a girl a long time ago in Washington State who was found in a Kmart. She was 3 years old, and she was by herself. They couldn't watch the security tapes, couldn't find anyone who was with her. And ultimately, I think it was like hunters found her mom's body in the woods, and she had been stabbed to death. And so they didn't find the dad. And the working theory for a long time, because they had a really volatile relationship, they'd all gone out looking for a Christmas tree, even though I think one of them had a restraining order against the other. But and they thought that the dad had killed the mom, dropped the girl off at the Kmart, and left. And then I was reading the newspaper, and there was an article in there that a woman walking her dog had come, the dog had come back with a bone in its mouth, and they tested it. It was a human bone. It was the dad's. And now they realize that whoever killed both parents took the little girl and dropped her off at the Kmart, probably figuring she was too young to say what happened. And so I'm taking that story and using it as the jumping off point. In real life, I have a feeling it looks like there was a serial killer who might have been working in Washington State at the time. There was another couple who died around the same time.
Do you make some assumptions sometimes about crime stories in the news and are proven correct or not?
A lot of times maybe just as you get older, you get cynical. You watch the husband crying about the wife and please let her free or whatever. And then, of course, he's the one who killed her. So I guess I have gotten more cynical. And then sometimes I'm cynical and I'm wrong. I think, well, that person surely did it. And then it turns out it really was the stranger that killed the person.
Wow. All right. So the main public event is the one at Barnes & Noble. And it's at what time on Tuesday?
7 o'clock on Tuesday.
7 o'clock on Tuesday. If you want to see a little more and hear a little more from April Henry than you got here on the Jefferson Exchange. April, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at our website, jeffexchange.org. We also provide program topics and recordings and social media goodies on our Facebook page. Same links available on Twitter. On the Jefferson Exchange tomorrow at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the Ranch of Second Chances and what that's all about. We'll talk about the expanding of a statewide landslide database on the Oregon side. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of the book about parenting called All Joy and No Fun. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren, also at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of JPR. And have a great day.